We're talking to Mitchell Cohen, who's the author of Looking for the Magic, The Rise of Arista Records. It's from Trouser Press Books, available in paperback and on Kindle from Amazon. Mitchell, thanks so much for joining us today to talk about your new book.
No, thanks for having me on. I really do appreciate it.
So let me say, first of all, I'm really excited to talk to you. I finished your book this morning. I was a program director early in my career working when Arista began to be the label to watch. And you guys were wonderful about sending product to us to give away. We had a Melissa Manchester weekend and a Manilow weekend and stuff like that.
That's great to hear.
This story is really an important story for people to find out about. So you were in A&R and all this time. Tell people what that means.
A&R stands for Artist and Repertoire. In brief, it's the job where you look for artists to sign to the label, and then from that point on, you help them make their album. If it's a case where an artist needs outside songs, you try and find the songs or hook them up with the producer. If it's not an artist that needs outside songs, you help them pick their own best songs or find the concept for the album. Yeah, and I started doing A&R for the label long after I joined the label. I joined the label in the 70s and became an A&R guy there in the 80s.
Now, you talk about the history of Arista. You start off with its origins as Bell Records, which was a very singles-heavy label. You had lots and lots of artists whose names I recognize, whose music I recognize, that were on Bell. When Clive Davis takes it over, that's when it becomes Arista, and the focus changes to more album-driven sales, right?
That's exactly right. I mean, I wanted to get that pre-history in there because I think that's a relatively untold saga.
Yeah.
Of that Bell, Amy Mala era under Larry Utah, who had a very different A&R philosophy than Clive. He didn't make records. He hired people that made records. He made production deals with people that made records, and that's how he got Mitch Ryder and the Detroit Wheels and the Box Tops and Merrilee Rush and James and Bobby Purify. And, you know, just had a long and successful string of hit singles up until, you know, the Partridge Family and Tony Orlando and Dawn.
Right, right.
But Bell was not really in the album business. I mean, they made efforts and could once in a while have a hit album. They did with, the Partridge Family because they had a lot of hits and they were on TV.
Mm-hmm.
So when Clive Davis took over in 1974 and Bell became Arista, certainly he has an ear for a hit single, as everybody knows, but he also signed artists like Gil Scott-Heron and Patti Smith and the Kinks and the Grateful Dead that were not necessarily, you know, going to have singles on the charts.
I mean, right.
They were going to, if they got the, you know, acclaim and they played live and started to get attention on college radio, underground radio, alternative radio, that these artists could make an impact without the benefit of a hit single. Then, of course, if you got a hit single with an artist like the Kinks or Patti Smith, then, you know, then obviously you're off to the races.
A perfect example of this, and I remember distinctly, I still have the gray 45, the Grateful Dead, who'd always been an album band.
Yeah.
Interestingly enough, Arista releases their one and only top 40 hit, Touch of Grey.
Yeah, that came after. They had been away for a while. They had not been in the studio for quite a few years, and Arista filled the gap, you know, between Grateful Dead albums by putting out live albums, you know, for their fans and
mm-hmm.
stuff. But they were really not that much on the radar of the mass audience. I mean,
right.
Certainly for their fans who would go see them no matter where they played.
Right.
But then they came in and delivered A Touch of Grey, and, you know, it was one of those moments where you know you're in a conference room and you're hearing the new record. And you go like, oh, I get it. This is going to be everywhere. This is certainly going to be an AOR smash. And beyond that, I mean, it has potential to be a pop hit. It's like when you hear a record like that, or Because of the Night, or Kink's record like Don't Forget to Dance or Come Dancing, you go like, oh, this is one step beyond.
Yeah.
This is not just for their fans. This is for everybody.
Right.
And those are the records that excite you because you go like, oh, Patti Smith, the Grateful Dead, the Kinks, they're always going to sell a certain number of records, and good for them because they, you know, they're amazing. But if they get that one song, like A Touch of Grey or Because of the Night, then it's a whole other plateau. Right. Then it's like another realm entirely, and the whole landscape just alters. You know, it's just and the excitement within the company becomes exponentially hyped up. It's like, oh my God, you know, because we love this artist, you know, we stood by this artist, and now look where they are going. It's tremendously fun.
One of your first really superstar artists was Barry Manilow, a guy who kind of defied the normal thing. He had jazz sensitivity, but he was a great showman. I saw him in concert years and years ago in the height of his fame, and he just put on a great show. This is a guy who became a huge artist for Arista, but he also was a very gracious guy because he helped bring Dionne Warwick in, and she hadn't really been doing anything for a number of years after all the great work she did with Burt Bacharach and Hal David, right?
Right. Yeah, that's quite true. Clive says that, you know, he met Dionne Warwick backstage at a TV show that they were both on, and he asked her what was up with her recording career, and she said, "Well, I think I'm kind of done with the industry." She was kind of in a slump, and Clive told her, "Well, you might be done with the industry, but the industry is not done with you." And they started to talk, and he had acquired all this material from all these people that were sending songs to be considered to be recorded by Barry Manilow. I mean, you know, once you have hits, I mean, every songwriter sends you songs, and they're like, and so there were more Barry Manilow type songs than Barry Manilow could possibly record. And Clive said, "Well, what we find a female artist that could do some of these, and maybe Barry could work with her." And it turned out to be Dionne Warwick, you know, and I'll Never Love This Way Again was a huge, huge hit for her and brought her back and won her a Grammy. Shows, you know, you don't count anyone out. Yeah. You know, they've got, you know, the voice or the songwriting ability, like, you know, like the Kinks, you know, like Ray. There always can be that one record, that one song that turns things around. I mean, it certainly was. It was for Aretha. It was for the Grateful Dead. It was for the Kinks, and I think that's one of the things we learn. You know, as we spend time in the music business, is that it's very arbitrary. It's very capricious, but don't count anyone out.
Right.
You know, and I think that was part of the story that Clive was telling about himself. Yeah, you know, like when he would, you know, he was no longer at Columbia. He had started Arista. He had to reinvent himself with a new record label. And to an extent, it was his own vindication story, his own redemption arc. And he wanted to provide that for some of the artists on the label. And I think that's an important aspect of the Arista narrative, is that he gave these opportunities to people because he knew what it was like to be in that ravine, in that place where people are wondering whether you can do it again.
Well, he certainly understood what it meant to have to reinvent himself after he was let go from Columbia, where he'd had such incredible success and signed some of the great artists of the era. He certainly did a great job when he hired Dionne Warwick's niece, Whitney Houston, too.
Oh, my God. That was just, it was one of those moments where everybody, the first time they saw her, was just instantly infatuated with her, and she was just sweet and shy and remarkably gifted, and we all could see endless potential in her. And it, you know, it took a while to make that first record, and you know, he really did do an extremely great job with that, finding the songs, hooking her up with the right people. Her story is very, very well known, but the Whitney I remember is the one that just used to come up to the office and hang out in jeans and just want to escape from everyone else and just like sit on someone's sofa in the publicity department and hang. And she was a sweet girl. And I said, that's the Whitney I remember.
Thank you, Mitchell Cohen. I know you got to go. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks, Dave.
Hey, absolutely. Thank you. So we've been talking to Mitchell Cohen, whose new book, Looking for the Magic, New York City, the 70s and the Rise of Arista Records. It is from Trouser Press Books, and it is available in paperback and Kindle from Amazon. I'm Doc Kirby for WTBF.